Blog Talk Radio.
From my heart and from my hand, why don't people understand my intention?
Zion, Zion, Zion.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the 50th installment of the Black Girl Nerds podcast. My name is Jamie. I am your host. You've guessed it from the intro to that song. We are doing a show today about science and all things related to science on a pop culture level, as well as a level of what's happening in our community with STEM fields and the popular hashtag movement in social media, Black and STEM. We have two guests who are experts in their respective fields. Sharif Jackson and Danielle Lee is on the show with us. So please give them a warm welcome. But before I give them their introduction that's due, I want to make a couple of announcements. So we have a store. It's called Blurredgasm. You can buy stuff. We have T-shirts, coffee mugs. We've got mouse pads, tons of content with our logo on it. We've got two logos now, one with the old logo and the new logo. So please feel free to purchase items in the store. And I know that today is Mother's Day, so happy, happy Mother's Day to all of you moms out there. And it's not too late. Mother's Day is not over yet. You can get her a gift from the BGN store. So check that out. It's www.zazzle.com/blurredgasm. And if you've already purchased products from the store and you're like, I really don't want to wear any merchandise with the BGN logo on it, but I do want to support your podcast, you can go to blackgirlnerds.com, go to that right sidebar. There's a donate button from PayPal. Click it. And please donate, because all of the monies that you do put into our site, our online community, and these podcasts, it helps us continue these podcasts from week to week. They do get expensive and pricey, and we want to keep these going for you. So thank you for all your continued support to all of you that have already donated. So, as I mentioned before, we have two great guests. We've got both Sharif and Danielle on the line. So I'm going to start with introducing both Sharif and Danielle, and then we'll get started with our questions. If you do have questions for our guests, you can always hashtag us on Twitter by using BGN Podcast. That will invite you into a feed where live listeners are tweeting, asking questions, giving comments, and I'll retweet them throughout the show. And you can also listen to us via Blog Talk Radio by calling in, and you don't have to necessarily be on the call, but you can listen in that way. And if you want to talk to our guests, you can call. 347-237-4616 is our phone number, and you can call and have any questions or, you know, add any kind of commentary to the discussion. All right, so Sharif Jackson, Sharif's views on science and technology have been featured on sources such as NPR, Scientific American, NASA TV, and This Week in Blackness. His science blog, sharifjackson.com, has won the Black Weblog Award for Best Science and Technology Blog in 2012 and 2013. By using the tagline, "Science Looks Good," Sharif breaks down science in a way that the average person can understand. And Danielle Lee, Danielle is an American biologist. Lee completed her BS in animal sciences at Tennessee Technological University, her MS in vertebrate zoology at the University of Memphis, and her PhD in biology at the University of Missouri of St. Louis. Lee was named one of the 10 White House champions of change in STEM diversity and access. Lee authors The Urban Scientist on the Scientific American Blog Network. Please, guys, give these folks a warm, warm welcome. Thank you, Sharif and Danielle, for being on the show today.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for having us.
Awesome. Good stuff. So I'm going to start my first question with Sharif. The TV series Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, it's a fan favorite in the nerd community, and a series that you live tweet every week. So what do you find cool about Cosmos, and why does it still resonate with people today?
Well, I think one great thing about Cosmos is that a lot of people – I think most people are interested in science, but they're really looking for someone to kind of walk them through the cool parts of it, like kind of skip a lot of the equations and the sort of, you know, really complicated kind of in-depth stuff. Like, they just want somebody to kind of break it down to them that's approachable and a personable. And Carl Sagan was that in the original 1980s version of A Cosmos when he hosted that. And Neil deGrasse Tyson is the same way in the current version that's now on Fox. I just feel like you really need a great host to kind of bring the cool things out. And I think that Dr. Tyson has been doing like a great job of that. It also resonates with me personally because, you know, as a 80s kid, like I grew up with the original Cosmos. Even though I didn't quite know exactly who Carl Sagan was or anything like that, I did enjoy the original series. And then when I saw the movie Contact, which was dedicated to Carl Sagan, which came out kind of shortly after his death, I was like, whoa, cool. And then I read the book after college, and then I ended up buying all his books and being borderline obsessed. So I think one of the great things about it is like just putting things in a way that people can understand with all the spectacle and special effects of television.
How has the live tweets been going for you since the new version with Neil deGrasse Tyson started?
Oh, they've been going great. I mean, you know, I always enjoy participating in live tweets. I mean, like the gem one that you guys do is awesome on Saturdays. and then if there's a show on like Game of Thrones or Arrow or something like that, that I really enjoy. Like, I feel like Twitter has really revolutionized watching television, and is really one of the few reasons that I watch things live anymore, you know,
right,
is to be on Twitter. So I thought, hey, if it works for those, why can't it work for a science show? And the response has been really, really good. Like, my blog traffic has gone up. I've gotten some really great followers.
Nice.
And I've gotten a lot of people that disagree with this stuff too, and they've been kind of contributing on the Science Looks Good hashtag during the show. So it's really been, just a great beneficial experience. And it's definitely not going to be limited to Cosmos, as other shows come out that, you know, are important and scientific. I definitely plan on doing the same thing.
And to Danielle, you're an American biologist, and you're studying right now with animal sciences, and we're going to go into some depth further on about what you're doing now with rats. But did you always know that you would be a scientist, and what led you to this line of work?
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to make sure you can hear me all right, right?
Yes, perfect.
Good, yes. I didn't know I was going to always be a scientist. No, not at all. I was very, very fortunate. I got lucky, and I ended up where I needed to be. But for a long time, I didn't comprehend that science was a career. My only comprehension of science, if you like, anything scientific, in my case, I love being animals. I love watching animals, was be a veterinarian. So I was focused on something more health-related, like either being a doctor or being a veterinarian. I had zero comprehension that you could do anything else besides those two things.
Did you watch a lot of science shows growing up and things like that?
Absolutely. I was that kid who watched Wild Kingdom. That was my show.
Yes.
The Mutual of Omaha series, I was like, that's the life I want. Like, I'm like, I want to be out there with Jim. Chasing wild animals. And I had those sets that they sold on commercials with the green box, and you had all the animal cards. That was me. I had all those. I had that too.
Oh my
yes.
God. Yes.
I had all the wild animal zoo series. Yes, that was me. I wanted to go zoo, my favorite place. I was always all about the animals. And how I ended up becoming in pursuit of trying to get into veterinary school, I was unsuccessful. The biggest blessing in disguise, not getting accepted. And I started taking classes. So I graduated college. So I had a degree in hand, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do or what I could do, because then I was facing the reality that if I don't get into vet school, I still have to feed myself sometime in this life. I still want to do something with animals. And so I was taking graduate-level courses to improve my chances of getting into veterinary school. And in one of my classes, we had to write a lot of papers and design experiments, and you had some research experience, and I loved it. I was completely turned on to research, and that was my track from then on. And I realized that being an academic, so being a scientist, you know, in an academic setting, so a college professor, is how a lot of people achieve these, you know, goals of being a scientist. And so then that became my focus.
Nice, nice. It's so funny that you bring up the green box with the cards and the animals, because I had that too. And it was my brother and I growing up. And we used to play like a game where we would like slap the card on the ground and see which animal came up and be like, my animal can kill your animal.
Oh, my gosh. So you all did the first verses.
Exactly. So, yeah, good time. That's so funny that you bring that up. So to Sharif, you have a blog on your site called sharifjackson.com. Why did you decide to start a science blog?
Well, I've been blogging since about 2003 when I was in grad school and needed something to not, jump out of a window out of all the work I was doing. And my blog first started, it was kind of a personal rant blog. You know, this was back in the, first I had a GeoCities blog.
I coded, wow.
That I coded in HTML myself, which was awesome. So of course it looked like crap. And then I moved up to Blogspot, back before they got bought by Google. And I had a personal blog, you know, it was just all rants and that kind of stuff. But basically, as my experience with the internet evolved, I started to use it more for personal business and networking and stuff. And my internet, like in 2003, it was more like my internet friends were just my internet friends. It was no crossover, right, with like sort of real life and the internet, I feel like, the way it is now. So as that began to blur, I found like, hey, you know what? I probably need an online presence that is me in real life. You know, like I don't need these two separate people. So I knew that obviously I've always had interested in nerd stuff and science and math and stuff. So I knew I wanted my own website, but I also wanted a blog that sort of is somewhat focused on one of those things. Because I didn't want to have sort of a general everything blog. I felt like that would have been too much. So I thought that science kind of is the cornerstone of, you know, everything I like, because it's like the curiosity, the engagement, the willingness to question, and the, you know, constant testing of hypotheses and throwing out ones that, you know, don't fit your evidence. Like all of that sort of, I feel like, underlines really a lot of the other things that I'm into, from games to comic books and all that stuff. So like that's kind of why I decided to start it for myself. And I also wanted to have a place where, you know, science is discussed in a fun way, and a place where, you know, even if all you want to do is see some cool photos or videos and not really go into sort of the deep depths of the stuff that I'm talking about, that you can still enjoy it, so that you can enjoy it on multiple levels. I've often kind of had people ask, like, well, like, why don't you sort of do a really in-depth science blog? And I'm like, well, that's kind of preaching to the choir to me. Like, you know, my goal is really to get people that don't think they like science to appreciate things, you know, and that's sort of been like the undercurrent of the science looks good hashtag that I use on Twitter and Facebook and stuff, you know. So it's been pretty successful. I'm pretty happy with it. It's something that I'm confident enough in that it's one of the first things on my blog, and on my resume. And every time I go into a job interview, they usually comment like, hey, like, that's a really nice website you got. I really, you know, like it. So it's something that's really become sort of my personal branding, like my, you know, me in the online space. So that's kind of how I started and like how that's evolved.
And Danielle, you also blog. What intrigues you most about science? And tell us about the work that you do on Scientific American.
So I started blogging in 2006 as a blogger as well, like on Blogspot, before it was picked up by Google. And I just wanted a way to talk about science in a way that I thought would engage my friends and family, because they weren't really being engaged by what we call the traditional science media. And I wanted a place to kind of put all that stuff together, because we used to send out like these weekly email links, like essentially it would be the equivalent of Link Love. And the blog was just the easier way to kind of put all that neat information out there and to share a lot of the stuff that I was doing. And so I really got interested in blogging as an extension of the outreach I was already doing. So I was working in a high school as a, not quite a science teacher, but I was a resource scientist. So instead of teaching undergraduate classes like many graduate students do when you're in school, I had an opportunity to work in a local high school. And so that was my assistantship. And that's what I did. And the kids were doing some amazing things, but they also were teaching me a lot of things about authentic research and authentic outreach to underserved audiences. So they were the classic, these students were not interested in science. They said they hated it. And I had the challenge of trying to get them excited about it and teach these lessons. And so it was also a way for me to catalog the things I was learning about effective teaching and effective outreach. You know, we say we want to reach these underserved audiences, but if we don't have a realistic grasp of what they're interested in and why they're turned off on it, then we won't come up with a really good way of reaching them and engaging them. And so it was just a way to do all that. And then I got invited to join Scientific American when it started its own blog network in 2011 because of the writing I had already done at two of my blogs. So one was Urban Science Adventures, which was focusing on a lot of experiential education with teenagers, so middle and high school ages. Then I started a different blog, which focused mostly on at the college level or above. So I talked about a more adult subjects by focusing on sexual selection, so still using what I call approachable and relevant language for audiences that my family and friends would relate to talk about, you know, evolution and evolutionary biology, but I explained everything with hip-hop songs. And then when I got picked up at Scientific American, I decided to kind of blend all of that together, so both my teacher voice and as well as my voice with friends to talk about science in general. And I really do emphasize, how do we bring underserved audiences to not just Scientific American, but other publications like that? If you look at any of the popular science magazines, the print is where a lot of these things started. So whether it's Scientific American or Discover or National Geographic or Popular Science, the average reader is a 49-year-old white male with a college education. Those are the people, for the most part, that audience is primarily self-selected. And even when we talk about black nerds and blurs, we're still self-selected, but we represent a really, really small percentage. And so building up, essentially, not just, you know, in attracting blurs to these magazines, but attracting the rest of our community who may not self-identify and self-select as blurs to still get intrigued and interested in talking about science. And so that's what brought me to Scientific American, so that you have not just a larger platform, but then to bring these audiences to these type of media vehicles, which have been, they catch what they can. They haven't been very deliberate in their strategy in reaching new audiences, a lot of audiences.
And on Twitter, I'm just looking at some of the tweets here, and this actually leads me to a question that I want both of you guys to answer. So Black in STEM, hashtag Black in STEM on Twitter, says that what got them into science, their tweet is, it was 3-2-1 contact for me, that water drop in the opening credits. And that just – I just got excited by seeing that, because that's what got me into science. And you don't – really see those shows on TV anymore. 3-2-1 Contact is one that I remember. Mr. Wizard was another one I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Even Beekman's World, I remember watching that, and that really intrigued me. A lot of they did it in a very comical and slapstick way of presenting science to the listeners and to the audience. So my question is, do you see those shows now? Have they become passé? Or, I don't know, maybe because we're adults now, we don't pay attention to those kind of shows that reach younger audiences. What are your thoughts about those shows kind of not really being in the mainstream anymore?
I think the media is so many options now. And that was actually one of my first goals when I first started blogging. That was my initial dream. Is I'm like, I would love to have my own science show and host it. I think they're still out there. I think being an adult, we've gotten a lot of things off our radar. I think the audiences have really been fragmented. They're focusing on younger and younger audiences. And it's harder to find what I would call good, wholesome programming for tweens and teenagers that's not at the same time too dorky. You know what I mean? It can, in the process of trying to be, you know, appeal to the audience, it can then be a little unrealistic. I think they're out there. I think there's a lot of minor things coming up. In fact, I know a young lady in California who's really trying to get her own science show off the ground, focusing on young people, Katmanda. She's out of the Bay Area in California. I think the web is going to be the way to go for a lot of these programs. And then maybe here and there they'll get picked up by the PBSs and the Nickelodeons and the Disneys. But I think the audiences have changed because the media landscape has changed. What do you think, Sharice?
Yeah, I agree with you on there being more options. I mean, you know, I think back when we were growing up, you know, Nickelodeon was kind of just coming out, and Mr. Wizard was one of their big early shows, you know, and PBS, in my opinion, was more of a, you know, they had more mainstream impact with their shows. Like, I was also a big fan of Square One on PBS also. They had a lot of good math stuff on it. So I think that because there were less options, it was easy to get sort of, you know, more attention for things. I think that there are a lot of science shows out now, but there's very few that sort of hit that, you know, that buzz, I guess, like that, like you would call it, right? And there's, but like now, like on the flip side of that, the Science Channel, there's National Geographic Channel, like there's entire media platforms based on it. It's like out there. It's just more like it might take, you know, some more effort to find it. I think that, like, you know, one of the worst things about it is more of the school teaching, but that's kind of like, I think, I guess, a whole different thing. But, like, you know, I don't know. I think it's there. It just needs to be encouraged a little more. And, I mean, I actually read that Cosmos was initially just supposed to be on National Geographic. And it was really, McFarlane that, stepped in and like said, hey, we need to get this, you know, on Fox and on, you know, on national broadcast TV. So it's really his influence that got it from a science dedicated channel onto a show like Fox and sort of a prime viewing time, you know, like
wow,
you know, so like it really kind of takes that kind of effort, I feel like, to get these kind of shows that are on like big channels during times where people are paying attention.
And let me ask you this, Sharice, kind of piggybacking off of what we discussed with just outreach to young kids, for those who have no interest in science or find it to be boring, what would you say to those people?
Well, I would say that everybody is exposed to science, even if they don't want to admit it or know it. So it's, to me, that usually ties down to the way it's being shown to them is in a boring way, you know?
Yeah.
And that's usually true. I mean, to be honest, like, I've done my fair share of science and math tutoring, and like when the students are going over sort of how they're learning this stuff, you know, in class and that kind of stuff, I'm just like, I'm falling asleep when they're explaining it to me. You know, so I feel like, like, you know, obviously everybody's not going to be a hardcore scientist, right? I mean, I was trained as an engineer, but I've gone more on the business analysis side, so I'm more on the programming side. So I'm not like, you know, I don't have my doctorate or anything like that. But that shouldn't be the expectation. But the expectation should be that people, especially our kids, you know, are questioning things, are using analytical methods, like scientific methods, to look at the problems of the world and that kind of stuff. Like, you know, that's really the importance of science. And that's what, you know, I think is what we really need to be pushing, as opposed to, hey, you can go in this lab and wear these goggles and do this stuff. Because that's not going to be everybody. But the ideas behind science can be everybody.
Yeah.
Danielle, you're currently working in your lab with pouched rats. Tell us more about this project and what exactly makes pouched rats so special.
So pouched rats are very large rats. They're actually not rats, which means nothing to the average person. Like, now I'm splitting hairs. They're called pouch rats because they have cheek pouches like hamsters, so they're more closely related to hamsters than sewer rats, per se. But if you were to look at one, they look like a rat. They have the long, pointy nose, the big ears, the wide whiskers, and the long, scaly tail. And they're really large. They are about the size of a house cat, so their body can be anywhere from 12 inches to 14 inches, and then you double that if you include their tail. So it's a pretty big rat. And what makes them special is that they have been successfully trained to detect landmines as well as tuberculosis. So they have an amazing ability to be biodetectors to possibly save human lives, and either the biomedical sense as well as in security and defense.
Wow. What have you found so far in your studies, and what kind of findings did you come up with so far?
I'm figuring it all out. So this is what's awesome about this rat. We know they can do that, but so they were trained by an organization, by a humanitarian organization, a social entrepreneurship group, that essentially that's their business model, is to train rats. But they're not scientists, and I am what you would call more of a natural historian scientist, so I ask animals for their own sake, not necessarily because of the application. And so I'm now trying to piece together all the basic information about the animal to understand more about how we can streamline training possibilities. So what I'm finding out is just reaffirming the fact that we know so little about this rat. I am literally on the ground figuring it all out. Things like, so I go to Africa every year for about 3 or 4 months, and I do field studies, finding the animals in the wild, tracking them. We need to know things like how do they live? You know, how long do the parents stay together and mate, or do the male and female mate and then they go their separate ways? How long do young stay with the mom? I have some good hints as to what's going on. I can make a really good guess. You know, as we're doing all this research, we know that they're a very long-lived rat. They can live up to 7 to 8 years, in captivity, and they seem to have delayed reproduction. So I've caught females who, by all estimates, are not very mature, but they're large in size. So trying to figure everything out. So my studies have been both in the wild and doing some lab studies to look at fine behaviors, and I'm literally analyzing it all now. And so what I'm finding so far, just really, really early, is that I'm beginning to see at least differences between males and females, like very broad differences in their behavior and how they react to the same stimuli. So, you know, in most animals, you expect at least, you know, for that particular species, that species has an average behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And that, we see that in the rats, but they have essentially two different, it's bimodal. The females have an average, and then the males have an average. And so the males and females react to the same types of stimulus in very different ways. And that just gives us hints into, it may seem simple, but little things like that can give us hints into their mating system. And it would suggest that the males and females are probably not living together because they're not reacting the same way. They have, they're on a different course. They have different objectives. They're in the real world. And so they react to things a little bit differently.
So the way the males and the females react to each stimuli, is that at all translated to ways humans react? Is there a difference between way men and women react to, you know, different illnesses, diseases? Are you finding that in your studies?
Well, I'm not looking at diseases right now. I am truly just looking at basic behavior. And so the closest I can liken it to for humans is, in humans, there is a difference in male-female responses to what we call anxiety. In humans, mm-hmm. women are more likely to be diagnosed and have psychological issues related to nervousness, anxiety. Women tend to be the highest population that get prescribed anti-anxiety drugs. So something like that would be the equivalent of that. So how females and males react to stress differently, whether it's acute stress or chronic stress. So those would be some of the similarities to look at. How males and females react differently to certain stimuli, particularly stressful stimuli.
Mm. Is it only rats that you're working with, or are you working with any other animals?
Right now, I'm primarily working with the pouch rats. Every now and then, I'll lend a hand to the graduate students in the lab, and they're studying prairie voles. I've studied prairie voles before in the past as well.
Cool. Wow.
Yeah.
Sharif, tell us about your educational background in science and what courses or avenues should students take to better prepare themselves to become scientists?
Sure. So my background, sort of in elementary and high school, I was always sort of interested in math and science and that kind of stuff. So I went to college as an engineering student, graduated as an electrical engineer. But at the time I graduated, it was sort of around that dot-com bust of the early 2000s, where a lot of, tech people were getting laid off because they were young and that kind of thing. So I decided to, go more the business route. So I went to business school, got that degree, and most of my work has been in as a business analyst, which a lot of that is like a lot of database programming, a lot of data analysis and manipulation, like basically kind of showing companies what their data means and how to use it to make better decisions. So that's definitely, within sort of the STEM field. I would say in terms of what classes that you should take if you want to be a scientist, I would say on the high school side, and I especially know this because I interview for my college, is that definitely try to take as many math and science courses as you can, which might make sense, but at a lot of schools, you don't have to take 4 years of either of those, So, like, a lot of people, they'll get up to, like, pre-calculus or whatever and just stop, or there's some people that will be done. I mean, I've seen kids done with their math at the end of sophomore year even, with the requirements to graduate. And I would say, definitely keep going, make sure that you take 4 years of both of those, most high schools, you'll get like your physical science, biology, chem, and like physics, and then with math, it'll be, algebras, geometry, pre-calculus, and then calculus. As far as in college, I guess it depends on what kind of college that you go to, because like some colleges have core requirements where you'll kind of be forced to take a math or science class, I think one of the most important things with college is that college is all about choice and experience and sort of trying things out, right? So, even if you have a remote interest in something, I'd advise that you take a class. I mean, worst case, like scenario, like, if you really hate the first couple of days, you can bounce, but I think that is really important to take that step, and that goes whether it's a science course, English course, anthro course, history, like college is really that time to, try things out. And I would say that when you go into the, obviously if you chose to go the graduate route, they're going to be really looking at, at your you know, specific science and math experience. I'm sure Danielle could speak a little more on that. But like when you go into the workforce, they're really going to be looking for not only that you have your content knowledge in terms of science and math, but also that you're well-rounded, right? So like you can't just be math and science. Like you have to be doing other things to be competitive. So I really think that's kind of the path that you should try to aim for if you're looking for that kind of career.
Yeah.
Do you need to have some sort of, or I should ask, are there any fellowship or internship programs that will help prepare you with that hands-on experience? Because I know that that's what a lot of employers want for the most part. They want to see that you've done the work. Having an academic background that's impressive and high SAT scores and all of that is good, but they want to see that you've actually done the work in this profession so that they can hire you. So are there any internship or fellowship programs that you can recommend or that you know of that would help people to be able to get those science fields?
Especially if you're looking at the natural and physical sciences, I think it's a little bit different than engineering in that I found that engineering internships tend to be a part of the curriculum, whether it's deliberate or not. There seems to always be some sort of infrastructure at the university level to really assist students in getting those internships. What do you think, Sharif? Would you say that's true in your experience as an engineering student?
Yeah. I think that's definitely true. I think to add on to that also, a lot of people don't really start hitting up career services until they need a job when they're about to graduate. Like, hit them up really early. First of all, they'll be thanking you because they're bored half the time because people never go until like 5 days before they graduate. But they will hook you up with the internships, you know, both them and networking with your professors, like talking with your professors outside of class. I had internships every summer in college, mostly at PSE&G, which is the utility company in Jersey. I did a lot of work on their geographic information kind of systems, how they map out like the piping and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I would definitely hit those career services places up.
Yeah. And this is where I think – this is where physical and natural sciences don't have that advantage. There really is no infrastructure for internships on the traditional science side, whether it's physical sciences or life sciences. And so a lot of that comes down to the work of the student and really getting to know your professors. And so but there are programs, and those programs are called REUs, Research Experiences for Undergraduates. And – some schools have them even for, like, high school programs. But that one's kind of hit or miss. And the problem with this is that it's individual schools that have special programs that go on throughout the summer. And what you need to do is you need to watch the bulletin boards at your university. So whenever you walk down the hallway and you always see these bulletin boards with these pictures of students, like, apply for this, apply for that, that's usually where they just randomly tack those REUs. And they are almost always paid. They can be at your home institution, but usually not. And you'll work at a university. You'll live on campus usually. You'll get a stipend, and you get experience in whatever the field is. We tend to call our experiences in the life sciences lab experiences or field experiences. And you'll be a field assistant, or you'll be some sort of research assistant in the lab. Many of these programs, you've either been working alongside a graduate student or a professor working on an ongoing project, or they might give you a little project that you can expand on your own if you're really, really ambitious. And you should be able to get publications out of it. And so in the traditional, in the natural sciences, our currency is about publications, or at least the opportunity to produce research that can get you at a conference where you can present your findings. And that's really where it matters for us. It's like doing a research experience and going to a conference. The other way to do it is if you're not sure of what you want to do, a lot of professional societies have special programs to bring undergraduates to the conferences so that they can meet professors, meet graduate students, and go to the conferences, read the papers, go to the poster sessions. And people ask me all the time, I have yet to apply for a single job. Every position I've ever gotten, I've always been tapped for it. And that's mostly how it's done in the sciences. They see your work. They see you at conferences. Or they read your papers. And so you really have to work at networking as an undergraduate student. And so your first job is you need to come to class. You need to come to class. People really underestimate that. Like, oh, I showed up and I took the test. Think about it this way. It's not just about doing well on your grades. Your transcript matters, no doubt. But who's going to write those letters of recommendation for you?
Right.
If you need those letters of recommendation. The other thing I didn't realize until I got to the other side of the equation, so now becoming a graduate student, you get a back view of academia. Almost all professors know each other. Like, there are only a few degrees of separation, particularly if it's a field that you're interested in.
Yeah.
The college professor, if you're sitting in a science class and you're interested in researching something at a different school, chances are their professor knows that other professor personally, not just because they read their papers. And when you're asking for letters to get into graduate school or even medical school, if that's your route, or want to hear from their colleagues, that's what your professors are. They are the colleagues of those other professors in those professional and graduate schools, and they're essentially asking one thing. Is this student going to pull his or her weight, and do you vouch for them? Is this student going to succeed? Will they try hard? Even if their grades aren't that great, is there something about them that makes them just amazing and worth accepting into our program and investing some time and energy and money in? And so, not everything's paid, and if all else fails, push comes to shove, if you ever see an announcement in your department where they need people, usually for like these one or two off events, like we're having a big, big weekend and we need as many hands on deck just to help us collect something, show up for one or two of those a year. Those little things are essentially like little mini experiences. So try to take up some experiences, even if they're just one-off things, one afternoon here or there or a weekend here or there. Sign up to volunteer on a field project or a lab project, or sign up to do one of those dorky studies where you get, a pizza coupon. Those are research projects. Those are opportunities to see this is what's happening. And then strike up a conversation and ask the researcher what's going on. I'd be happy to do something else if you need to. Like right now, I'm in the process of, I need undergraduate assistants to help me. I need extra hands on deck. When you see these, I put up announcements in the hallway. Check them out. See if they're doing something that you're at least willing to give a few weeks of your time to learn more about. And if you don't like it, you're done. Most people won't ask you to do more than a month, a semester at a time. And if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But you can at least earn some open credit. And so you can sign up for research credit, which acts as a grade. Some places it's pass or fail. Other places, if you get a letter grade for it, you essentially can earn an A just by showing up and following directions.
Yep.
If you just show up and follow directions, you could earn 2 to 3 hours of an A. That bumps your GPA up immensely.
Right.
Yeah, and I think what you speak a lot to, Danielle, is really like putting the effort forth.
Yeah, you do.
Because I think a lot of people do have that mentality that you shared. Well, if I show up and take the test and I get good, then that means, I'm going to be good. But, teachers see that all the time. And if you put your best foot forward and you say go to office hours a lot, or or they're presenting somewhere on campus or off campus and you go to it, like they'll recognize that.
Yep.
It's really about, don't get me wrong, you definitely need the content and knowledge to back it up, but a huge part of it is showing you're interested, showing that you're willing to take that next step. It makes a world of difference.
Yes, I agree. Yeah.
And a lot of what you just spoke on can apply in every field. So if you're not someone that's going into a science field, I think a lot of what you said about the networking and the bulletin boards and having that relationship with your professor, that is very instrumental in getting the work that you need in any sort of internship or fellowship along the way, or even a job right out of school. So I really like those pointers that you give, because it can apply to all areas of academia, not just necessarily science.
Absolutely. And also look at it as a type of cross-training. Like, I've become acquainted with several artists and writers, and so their main thing is on the humanities and fine arts side, but they have an interest in science, and they use that to inform their craft. So they're artists who use science subjects as their muse, or these are the topics that they write about. And so there's cross-training that can be done of people who like history, but they're doing theses on, you know, essentially the history of science, or they're sociologists, right, but they study the sociology of science movements, or the sociology of how the public interacts with scientific discourse. So there's a lot of opportunity there. Like Cherie said, it's not about making everybody a scientist. This is about helping people become more scientifically literate. So embracing even the small s, you know, lowercase scientists within.
That's a really great advice. Really good. So I want to switch over to social media. And this question really is for both of you, because you participate in this hashtag. And we've got one of our tweeters here that's using the @BlackInSTEM Twitter handle. We hear and we see the word STEM a lot. And I know that you're part of the hashtag #BlackInSTEM movement that's on social media. So tell us exactly, what is STEM? And what is currently happening with Blacks in STEM? Sherif, we'll start with you and then go to Danielle on this one.
Sure. STEM is, you know, it's a acronym that, you know, that is science, technology, engineering, mathematics. Sorry, I don't know if you meant like an actual definition or what it means to me. I think it's really come into vogue a lot recently with sort of the reform of education with No Child Left Behind and some of the other things where people are saying, you know, how is this country going to remain competitive when, you know, we're kind of behind specifically in STEM stuff when you look at it sort of on a, you know, on an international thing. Like, we usually come fairly low and behind in a lot of the assessments. In terms of Blacks in STEM, I mean, I think that, you know, it's really important because, you know, a lot of us growing, well, I guess I'll speak for myself, not us, but, you know, I didn't grow up seeing a lot of diversity in STEM fields, right? And I think that's why a lot of us don't really conceive it as a career, you know?
Yeah.
Like, even given all the video games that I played as a kid, I never thought video game programming was a career, you know?
Even
now, when you think of a scientist, you think of a, you know, gray-haired, white male, you know, that
Albert
sort of,
Einstein looking, basically, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, and like, I think both subconsciously and consciously that does have a effect on not only us, but on people, on how people that aren't Black perceive what a scientist is. So like when I tell people, you know, that like I did engineering, and I get that, that kind of surprise, I'm like, why are you surprised? You know, like, it shouldn't be an outlier, you know? So I think that it is important for, for more diversity to get, in STEM fields, to diversify and give the future, like the kids of today and tomorrow, those examples, which is why I think Cosmos is so huge. Like, having, you know, a Black doctor hosting, you know, a nationally syndicated show is incredible, you know. And I think that, you know, if I'm a kid and I'm looking at colleges and I'm seeing, you know, that one seem a little more diverse, that's going to be more attractive to me. Yeah, that's like my thoughts on that.
How about you, Danielle? What are your thoughts about the STEM industry as it relates to diversity?
So it definitely needs some work. So less than 7% of the United States STEM workforce is African American. and about an equivalent number of Latin Americans. So you're looking at a STEM workforce that is primarily about more than 50% white male, just white male alone. And then all the rest is divvied up between Asian Americans, Native Americans, which are barely a percentage point, Black Americans and Latino Americans. That's, we're missing a lot of diversity of thought, not just who's in the room. And like Sharice said, I get the same looks too. You know, when I tell someone, you know, I have a PhD in science, I inevitably get people to go, so what year in school are you? I'm like, no, I'm done with school.
I'm done.
You know, or when people are asking questions, or, you know, when people are asking questions about the pouch rats, and, you know, and I'm like, no, I'm the person you have to ask that question to. They don't look around for anyone else. It's me.
Wow.
And so, and that just like Sharice said, it's not just African Americans who are pleasantly surprised by it, but it's other people who are surprised. Like, we're still dealing with this surprise, and so we need to change. We need to shift that equation so we can quit. We can get to the business of talking about the science. Talking about yes, I happen to be one. I am excited about the hashtag because it is it's really been a clarion call for a lot of African Americans on Twitter who may not have initially self-identified as scientists. And so there were a lot of people who were on Twitter, and they were talking about things, but they weren't self-identifying as scientists and engineers or science and math educators. And a lot of them are, and they're contributing to these education, to the conversations. It also alleviates the response and the excuse we get from media, as well as other folks who keep saying that they don't know where to find folks from other backgrounds to speak on panels or to quote in stories. And I think that's the other thing I'm excited about. I like it for that. And I tend to use it for that, too. People are like, well, I'm looking for it. Then you need to use the hashtag Black and STEM so you can find someone,
right,
you know, in these many, many different areas of not just interest but expertise. I mean, there's a lot of expertise out there that has been just under-acknowledged and under-known about. So that's why I see social media going. It's really helping to broaden our all of our voices and to just raise more attention into the number of career opportunities that African Americans have already stepped into and are taking a part of and showing leadership in.
Good stuff. Well, we're almost at the end of the show. Before we go, give out your social media shout-outs and your websites and any current projects you're working on, where our listeners can find out more about what you're doing, starting with Sharice and then Danielle.
Sure. So I'm basically Sharice Jackson, S as in Sam, H-A-R-E-E-F as in Frank, Jackson on, you know, most social networks, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Google+, all that stuff. Website is sharifejackson.com. Hashtag is Science Looks Good. And I do a podcast, Operation Cubicle, at operationcubicle.net. And I also work with Danielle on the National Science and Technology News Service. So that's my stuff.
Yes, and I'll start where he left off. So the National Science and Technology News Service is the immediate advocacy group of African-American scientists and engineers, as well as health and science and environmental journalists, to help increase the amount of just quality science news coverage in the media targeted to African-Americans. And we are also on Twitter as The Dark Side, so PHEDARKSTI. You can find me on Twitter, usually talking about science and or clapping back on someone, especially if they get their science information incorrect. I am at DNLee5 on most platforms, primarily Twitter, as well as my blog on Scientists in America, The Urban Scientist. And so you can look me up. I have a Facebook group page, The Urban Scientist, and... But you can find everything, one-stop shop for me is if you go to my About Me page, so about.me/DNLee. So that gives you a little background into what I do and a few of the projects. So, and I'm presently really, really focusing. I'm getting ready for my next field season. And when I'm out in the field, as well as when I'm in the lab, I give live Twitter updates. So you get to see me and my rats and all the shenanigans they get into, usually at the hashtag DispatchesDNLee. That's when I'm in the field in Africa. And when I'm in the lab, is hashtag DNLee lab. And you'll probably see me really blowing up a lot of other black and simmers coming up this summer. So I'm focusing this summer on really using my platform to bring attention to other black and stemmers out there in social media, as well as in the professional landscape, so that more people will know all the amazing things that black and stemmers are up to.
Good stuff. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. We brought a lot of awareness. There's some folks on Twitter that tweeted that they didn't even know about the Black in STEM hashtag on social media. So I'm glad that this show has brought awareness to you guys. Thank you again to Danielle Lee and Sharif Jackson. Next week at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we have Decepticomics. It's a group of five really, really funny guys. It was actually one of the funniest shows that we've done on BGM Podcast. They were on last year, and they will be back again next week to bring on their crazy shenanigans, and hopefully we don't get foam bombed again like we did last year. But they'll be on our show next week, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And then after that, we are going to take a brief hiatus for the summer. So we'll go on break until fall so folks can enjoy their summer vacation. So definitely, you can always go to Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, Stitcher, and download all of our archived podcasts. Thank you so much for tuning in, and thank you, guys. Thank you, Sharif. Thank you, Danielle. What a great show.
Thank you. It was fun.
Yeah, awesome. Always a good time.
Finally, take care. Finally.